Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Speaker Johnson promising the Ukraine aid bill will be on the House floor on Saturday as the far-right Republican pro-Putin caucus intensifies their threats against him. We'll go to Ukraine to discuss how Ukrainians feel about the small minority obstructing the flow of desperately needed arms and ammunition, as at least 31,000 of their soldiers have died defending their country from Putin's invasion, a death toll which U.S. intelligence suggests is more like 70,000. Joining us is Ilya Ponomarenko, a Ukrainian journalist known as a former defense and security reporter at the Kyiv Post and subsequently a co-founder of the Kyiv Independent. He has covered the war in eastern Ukraine since the conflict's earliest days, as well as Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022. He's also had deployments to Palestine and the Democratic Republic of the Congo as an embedded reporter with UN peacekeeping forces, and he won the Alfred Friendly Press Partners Fellowship and was selected to work as USA Today's guest reporter at the United States Department of Defense. We'll discuss his new book out next month, I Will Show You How It Was, The Story of Wartime Kyiv. Then, with two seated jurors now quitting the New York Trump trial as the criminal defendant defies the gag order, posting wild accusations against the jurors and testing the patience of the judge, we will speak with Scott Horton, a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. Then finally, we'll look into how Musk and Bezos, two of the richest men in the world, along with Starbucks billionaire Schultz and the Ulbricht family that own Trader Joe's, are trying to destroy unions by getting rid of the National Labor Relations Board that has protected workers since the 1930s. Joining us is Stephen Greenhouse, a senior fellow at the Century Foundation, who was previously a reporter for the New York Times, where he covered labor and the workplace for 19 years. He's the author of The Big Squeeze, Tough Time for the American Worker, and Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. And we'll discuss his latest article at The Guardian, Trader Joe's and Starbucks are helping Elon Musk undermine the U.S. government, and victories would be nothing less than an earthquake. Can UAW win in the South? And before we begin, I would like to thank our listener donors who keep Background Briefing independent, corporate, and commercial free without paywalls or constant fundraising by making tax-deductible donations to our nonprofit foundation, the Public Truth Media Foundation, at publictruthmedia.org or at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. As we enter this fact-free and violence-prone election year, with much of the country under the cult-like spell of a deranged demagogue spewing constant lies while inciting hatred and violence, help us continue to seek out facts and information to awaken America's silent majority before our democracy is trumped by fascism. Ponomarenko, who is a Ukrainian journalist known as a former defense and security reporter at the Kyiv Post and subsequently a co-founder of the Kyiv Independent. He has covered the war in eastern Ukraine since the conflict's earliest days, as well as Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022. He also has had deployments in Palestine and the Democratic Republic of the Congo as an embedded reporter with UN peacekeeping forces, and he won the Alfred Friendly Press Partners Fellowship and was selected to work as USA Today's guest reporter at the U.S. Department of Defense. His new book out next month is I Will Show You How It Was, The Story of Wartime Kyiv. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ilya Ponomarenko.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us here. And I know you're in Bucha, of course, just outside of Kyiv, which is, we can talk about the horrible significance of that in terms of what the Russians did. In the story that you tell about the siege of, or the attempted capture of Kyiv back in 2022, which your book chronicles. But you also had a recent piece in Time magazine earlier, titled Do the Right Thing, America. And now, of course, on Saturday, the House is expected to vote on an aid, much delayed aid package for Ukraine. Do you think America will do the right thing?
I think yes. I think we're moving there. Has to be. It has to be. I must say that we in Ukraine had a lot of disappointment, a lot of distress about this whole situation, regarding the US aid and in general the political strife. And the subject of this political strife within the United States being the defense aid for Ukraine, because it's so essential, so vital for the survival of this country. So I'll be frank that saying that many people here in Ukraine, and myself included, we were ready to live with the fact that America going away. We were kind of getting ourselves prepared for the future without America and without American aid. So we were thinking about, other options of what we can do, which would radically affect the state of war and the state of Ukrainian defense, and in general nature of Ukrainian defense effort in this war. But thankfully, as it sometimes happens in history of mankind, and particularly in the US history, after long deliberations, after a lot of pretty unpleasant strife, I think we are moving there. So America kind of got back to its senses, especially when it comes to what we see right now today with all the statements from in the Congress from Speaker Mike Johnson. I think that was a quite pivotal moment in which America just kind of got back to its senses, and I think we'll go in there. Of course, we will have it when we see it, in our hands. But I think we've passed the climax of this crisis, already sorrowful crisis, I would say. So we're going there.
And when you talk about the aid package for Ukraine, there's 43.3 billion in security assistance, 23.2 billion for replenishing weapons and equipment from the DoD's inventory, 13.8 billion for the purchase of weapons and munitions for Ukraine from US manufacturers, 11.3 billion for continued US support to Ukraine through ongoing US military operations in the region. And of course, the overwhelming majority of this money will be spent here in the United States to American defense companies and U.S. and allied militaries. But I have to tell you, Ilya, here in the United States, it's almost incomprehensible that a handful of pro-Putin radicals in the House of Representatives, and we're only talking about, maybe 10 people, have hijacked this whole issue and have shut down the House in terms of getting this aid package to delivered as Russia amps up its attacks and knocked out 10% of Ukraine's electricity because, according to President Zelensky, they simply don't have the anti-aircraft missiles anymore. They've run out of ammunition. Needless to say, just a few days ago, the United States prevented about 200 ballistic missiles from hitting Israel, along with allied partners, using up a lot of its inventory of Patriot missiles, which Ukraine desperately needs. So, how do you feel about that? Or how do the Ukrainian feel about that? The idea that we're bending over backwards to help Israel, but not Ukraine?
Yes, I must say that, of course, I'm not going to lie to you that many in Ukraine, especially when it comes to, socially and politically active part of population, they are generally upset. The image of America has been harmed in many ways. The status of America as the general baker, the biggest supporter of this war, it's been compromised in the eyes of many people here in Ukraine and around the world, admittedly. And it really hurts to understand this and to see this, because America deserves way better than this, of course. Given all the aid that we have, given the fact that America even gives this aid, and given the fact that without any aid, all the aid that the United States have provided us since the beginning of the full-scale invasion, I think there would be no Ukraine by now. Would have been no Ukraine. So, of course, the biggest pain in this is that this whole strife, this whole crisis showed something that we never expected to see, which is, America being at a very real risk of walking out of this completely, because we were always feeling America as a universal backer that will always be there. We could always, count on this bipartisan support in the Congress, no matter what happens in the United States. The United States always understands that it's in the best interest of America to stay with us. And so no matter what happens, no matter who rules the White House, we still have the Congress, and both parties are with us on this. So, yeah, I think it's, in many ways, it's the role of America as the like beacon of hope. In many ways, compromised as the leader of the free world. But that's the pain. I would say that, if we talk about the less emotional thing, that's the pain of being a democracy and having a lot of things to decide upon. If we have Russia, there's just one voice, there's just one decision maker, and there can be any alternative views on points of what kinds of decisions should be made. When it comes to America, there are lots of people, lots of interests, lots of different points of view, and it's all about, the political struggle in this. So it's the pain and the pleasure of being a democracy. But thankfully, despite this, I think we're moving to correct decision, right decision.
But it seems there's always been some sort of ambivalence in terms of President Biden and his team with Blinken, the Secretary of State, and National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan. There seems to have been a sort of contradiction or a tension. On the one hand, the U.S. wants to prevent Russia from taking over Ukraine and they want to defend Ukraine. But on the other hand, they seem to be nervous about pushing Russia too far. And the U.S. is all throughout this since 2022. First of all, back in 2022, I think a lot of people didn't think that Ukraine would survive. And your book chronicles the extraordinarily brave and moving defense of the country, which is in many ways reminiscent of the Battle of Britain, when Britain stood alone in 1940 against the Nazis who'd taken over most of Europe. And when Churchill talked about their finest hour, your book really is about, in a way, Ukraine's finest hour. But for the longest time since the U.S. got involved in this war and stepped up, they've set red lines and then said, you can't have this missile, you can't have this plane, you can't have this, that. But then they, after a few months, they decide to change their mind and let Ukraine have it. And unfortunately, this delay has led to Russia building up formidable defenses, which meant that the offensive couldn't have gone through and recaptured Crimea, for example. So from your point of view there in Ukraine, what do you think is the problem here? Why is the U.S. afraid of pushing Putin too far?
I think the core of this problem, and it goes far beyond the United States, but in general, the West in modern times, is that the free world and, leadership in the free world for decades have been trained to be as riskless as possible, as safe as possible. Many leaders grew up in this environment of general peace and dependency on public opinion and the fear of, upsetting the public opinion because of the ratings, because of the voting, the options of democracy. So I think because of this pretty long period of peace that we experienced since the fall of the Soviet Union for like 30 years, this epoch of general peace, it's just a model of staying away from internal domestic troubles, staying away from being involved in dangerous wars and making risky decisions and problematic decisions, no matter how necessary and how historically demanded they are. So I think it's, in many ways, it's the structure of today's West and the today's world. So it feels easier and feel safer to stay away from making hard decisions, and that may not play too well, but nonetheless, they are required. So yeah, we have this model of many leaders just trying to avoid things like providing Ukraine with weapons, because it may and may not entail the risk of escalation, as they call it, and may not, the risk of nuclear conflict. And moreover, on the other side of the stable, dictatorship, particularly Russians, they understand this clearly, that the leadership is weak. They are very prone to go as riskless as possible, and they know the painful points to push on, such as this nuclear threat intimidation, such as gas prices, even by that far. So we end up having a situation in which Europe sees the worst European continental war since the time of Adolf Hitler, and meanwhile we have leaders who spend months, even sometimes even a year, contemplating and thinking and evaluating risks over should we or should we not provide Ukraine with certain weapons. And then they take another months to contemplate another weapon. So in many ways, the nuclear intimidation works on this regard, because again, this creates risks that not many leaders are ready to assume and to show before their voters, because there are always in democracies there are always someone who would not be talking about complicated decisions to complicated problems, who would rather go and adhere to populism and saying that to hell with this Ukraine, let's abandon them and let's live a peaceful life, without any risk, without anything that we have to pay for instance. There are always someone to suggest a simpler decisions and get more votes and more popularity at the moment. So that's the nature of today's West. The nature of today's West, and in general, the free world, and not only the United States, it just precipitates managers, but not, political, historical decision makers.
Well, there's also an anomaly, though, and that is the arrival of Donald Trump on the political scene as a president and now possibly a second-term president who is clearly tied to Putin in ways that we're not entirely clear about. And you mentioned going back to Adolf Hitler. Of course, Chamberlain treated at Munich, he treated Hitler as a diplomat, not as a thug. And in the case of Trump, he admires the thuggishness of Putin. And for the longest time, our diplomats have treated Putin as a diplomat and a leader as opposed to a gangster.
Yeah, of course, that's one of the things that not many people in the West talk about. But yeah, it was always the case. It has always been the case, but it's the case now that the Kremlin in general and Vladimir Putin in particular, they have been treated as serious Western politicians, something really similar to people that make decisions in the White House or the UN Congress in London and Paris. But in general, it's not a government, it's a mafia. It's a mafia state. There's a book about the rule of Vladimir Putin and his clique, and they come into power, and it's called Mafia State. And it's exactly what it is. It's a mafia. It's not these are not historical leaders or government managers or something like that. So yeah, it's a mafia. It's a gang. So in all features possible, it's a gang that has a nuclear power in its hands, and doing things with this nuclear power and its enormous resources, and in the mafia style, in the thuggish style. But when it comes to Donald Trump, yeah, we in Ukraine, we also like in this stream of being intrigued by the possible outcome of the future presidential elections. We of course understand that the approach of the United States towards this may be seriously compromised towards Ukraine, towards the settlement with Russia, or so-called settlement with Russia, which would be a delayed war in the Russians' favor. But at the same time, the sentiment in Ukraine is that, and we've seen quite a over careful politics and rather weak politics by the Biden administration. And many think about Donald Trump as a potentially dangerous figure, but also a figure who is very unpredictable, very impulsive, and someone who can potentially move tables around absolutely in a way that is not favorable by Putin, because it's all about Trump's ego, it's all about his own interests, and it's all always about, the lack of ties between what Trump says for media, for a lot of fuss that he produces, and what he actually does on the ground, particularly as the potential next United States president. So we'll wait and see what's happening. And of course, what we see from Donald Trump and his team and his potential future administration is not favorable for Ukraine at all. No one can accept what potential president of the United States says when it comes to, dealing with the Russian-Ukrainian war in 24 hours. That's not going to happen. And not because we do not want this, but because it's a very naive view on the wants and wishes of Vladimir Putin in this war and his desire to walk out of this war, which is absolutely not the case. So we'll wait and see. But what I like about this country in general, what I like about this position in this war, is that we have this very strong sentiment of doing what is right, whatever it takes, as long as it takes, and simply doing what we should about this, no matter what happens outside. So I think we've been to so many no's and nevers to this, more than 2 years of this full-scale invasion, that we have seen so many things and we have overcome so many impossible things, that we will find a way in any case, and we will be finding a way in any case. So we'll see.
But Ilya, just in closing, let me read the last paragraph of your book, which again is, "I will show you how it was, the story of wartime Kyiv." And you say at the end here, "So many Ukrainian soldiers and officers could have gone on breathing, listening to music, continuing with their careers, enjoying cold beer in the evening, holding the hands of their girlfriends and boyfriends and hugging their kids. But no. They sacrificed their lives to stop the army of those proudly serving a maniac's lowest instincts from coming into their homes to desolate, slay, and oppress. And they can't get anything in return for their ultimate sacrifice. It's over for them, too, as epochs come and go over the old battlefields and soldiers' graves. They will stay in the dark of non-existence forever." So that is a reminder, just in closing, of the price that Ukrainians are paying to defend their country.
Yes, I did conclude my book with these words, because these words came to me, and this thought came to me in the middle of the Battle of Kyiv, when I was witnessing with a bunch of with several foreign reporters. We were invited to witness the exchange of bodies be between Russian and Ukrainian sides. So we were to witness the exchange of six dead Russians for two living Ukrainians. There was a halt in hostilities, and we saw pretty ugly things when it comes to, unearthing, bodies of Russian soldiers buried in the mud, and then unearthed, and then to be sent to the front line in exchange for Ukrainian guys. And this thing came to me when I identified one of the soldiers that were exchange of that day, an officer, a commissioned officer, a Russian commissioned officer of Buryat origin. So I pretty accidentally got a lot of information about his personality. I Googled, Google can tell you a lot of things. And I saw not a monster, not a devil with hawks in his head, but a young guy, 24 years old, Asian, from really far away from the almost the area of the Mongolian border. But he died 7,000 kilometers away from his home in this unjust, idiotic war, one of the most senseless wars that ever happened on this planet. But at the same time, he lost his life. But at the same time, a lot of our guys had to die. They volunteered to die to stop him and also an army of the likes of him for the sake of what? That was my thought about this, is that, you know, this war isn't a crime in its own, but also it's an insane tragedy to all those people who could be alive, you know, all these guys just like me and you who were mobilized, who were soldiers, you know, they loved life too, but for the sake of essentially nothing, this war was launched and a lot of bad people were killed, but also a lot of good people who also wanted to be alive and enjoy life also had to die and died, and they keep dying every day. So I wrote this so that people around the world and in Ukraine too could appreciate this sacrifice, this immense sacrifice that the Ukrainian military is doing for us all. Because sometimes when we in Ukraine, we enjoy more or less peaceful life, more or less stable life in cities far beyond the front line. But they sometimes we fail to realize how much has been paid for this column. And it goes on.
Well, Ilya Ponomarenko, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Ilya Ponomarenko, who's an Ukrainian journalist known as a former defense and security reporter at the Kyiv Post and subsequently a co-founder of the Kyiv Independent. He has covered the war in eastern Ukraine since the conflict's earliest days, as well as Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine since 2022. He's also had deployments to Palestine and the Democratic Republic of the Congo as an embedded reporter with UN peacekeeping forces. And he won the Alfred Friendly Press Partners Fellowship and was selected to work at USA Today's guest reporter at the United States Department of Defense. His new book out next month is I Will Show You How It Was, The Story of Wartime Kyiv, and he joined us from Bucha, just outside of Kyiv. We're going to take a brief station break, back looking into how two-seated juries are now quitting the New York Trump trial as the criminal defendant defies a gag order, posting wild accusations against jurors and testing the patience of the judge. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Scott Horton, a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Horton.
Great to be with you, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us. And it seems that Donald Trump is pushing the envelope using tactics that taught to him by Roy Cohn to, you know, basically trash the law and do these mafia-like tactics of intimidating witnesses, intimidating jurors, etc. And I'm wondering whether Trump is trying to get himself jailed by the judge or fined, or is he crazy like a fox? Does he want this to happen, or is he just out of control? Because, you know, he just tweeted out last night, one of these Fox News propagandists' ridiculous claims that the jurors that are seated are all pretending to be neutral, but are in fact left-wing activists. And that's a direct violation of the gag order. they did unseat two of the jurors today, one because she felt that too much information had been released about her and her relatives had already figured out she was on the jury, and the other was unseated because of objections from the prosecutors. So what do you know about what happened today?
Well, I think you're asking a very fair question. So the way Trump is behaving, and to a lesser extent his campaign entourage are behaving, is not at all the way you would normally expect a defendant in a criminal case to behave. And it's he's engaged in tactics which certainly will not help him in the proceedings, which will make it more likely, I think, that he would be convicted. Certainly will offend gratuitously many of the jurors. So his strategy here obviously doesn't have to do with winning at trial. It has to do with winning an election, I think, and winning the election by dragging the judge and the entire legal process through the muck and convincing as many voters as he can convince that he's being treated unfairly. So I think that's the strategy, and whether it works or not is a major question. I think the judge is being extremely indulgent of him so far. So I think the prosecution has moved for a finding that he is in contempt, and the judge, rather than taking that on immediately, set it down for a hearing on Tuesday of next week. Now, I think that setting it down for a hearing that way is a suggestion, of course, that the judge views the claim of breach of the pretrial order as something extremely serious. So I think it's likely that some sort of sanction is going to come out of this. But I think it's also very, very clearly that this is something the judge does with tremendous reluctance.
So there was a lot of celebration, if you will, in the press about how the judge managed to seat seven jurors on Tuesday. And then, of course, Wednesday, the court shut down because Judge Merchan holds the mental health court. He's in charge of that. So they had a day off yesterday, and then today it doesn't look like they got much done. So is this, at the very least, another Trump delaying tactic?
I think it is. So I think that his strategy is to spin this out as much as possible, to delay it as much as possible. And I think he's got some witting helpers in the process. I mean, I think you mentioned previously Jesse Waters, the anchor for Fox News, and what he had done. I mean, I think Waters and what he did and what he said comes perilously close to being an attempt to obstruct justice by undermining the process of seating the jury. But in any event, it's definitely very carefully coordinated with Trump's own strategy and amplifying that strategy. And I think if this continues, it won't stop the process of putting together a jury, but it will delay it. It'll mean that it'll take more days. Now, he told the jurors who were already seated to plan to come back on Monday. And of course, we have at this point only a few hours left of today, and then we have tomorrow. And whether he will be able to seat the full jury of 12 people plus alternates in that period of time is, I'd say at this point, rather doubtful.
And Scott, we're just learning that they managed to seat 12 jurors today, so they're not slowing down. So is there a point, though, where the judge gets so fed up because Trump is testing his patience that he just says, okay, you're going to spend a night in jail or a few days in jail or give him a fine? I mean, is that likely? And does Trump somehow think that might be good for him? I just don't understand why Trump is pushing the envelope.
Well, I've observed these, questions of violation of pretrial orders in criminal cases in New York many times in the past. And usually the judges rule on them very, very quickly, and they're usually extremely harsh. So I would say if it's a borderline case, it might just be a fine or something like that. But if it's a serious matter, and I think jury intimidation, identifying witnesses when you've been told explicitly not to do that, making comments, public comments about witnesses, These are things that normally get a criminal defendant's bond revoked and get them sent to prison. So if he were a normal person, yeah, he would be, I think, headed to prison very quickly. But he's not a normal person, and the courts seem to indulge an awful lot from him. So what's going to happen in this case? My bet is that that Judge Merchan is going to assess some sort of fine and penalty. Maybe we'll put him on the stand and ask him what he intended when he did these things. And we'll tell him you can't do this anymore. So I think probably a fine and an admonition, and then we'll take it and see if he continues to engage in the same sort of conduct. But I would say repeated conduct would definitely mean revocation of the bond, going back to jail.
So, Scott Horton, just to broaden this out a little, one of the things about this case that's not often discussed, as I keep calling the hush money case, is in a way, if you have to go back to 2018 when Michael Cohen went to jail, and at the time, the U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York, Jeffrey Berman, he continued investigating the case. And he came under pressure from the Attorney General Bill Barr not to even mention individual one, meaning Trump, in the charging documents. And the pressure just grew and grew and grew to the point where Trump fired him. So it feels like a full circle in a way, because you start out with Cohen going to jail, sentenced by Berman, but the real culprit, Trump, gets off because, after all, he instructed him to do what he did, and it was for Trump's benefit. And now, finally, it looks like the slow wheel of justice has turned to the point now where Michael Cohen is likely to be the most important witness against Trump in this case.
I think that's exactly right. And I think you bring out one of the most important points here, which is that Michael Cohen was charged, was sentenced, did time. And under the sentencing guidelines that apply for this sort of case, when you have two individuals, one of whom is a professional agent who is doing something on behalf of a principal, the principal agency relationship is not exculpatory. The person can still be held to account. But normally then the principal who instructs, directs, and makes the payments will get a substantially harsher sentence than the agent would. So that means in this case, Trump would have been charged and would have faced a far more severe sentence than Michael Cohen faced. And that didn't happen. And we know that that didn't happen not because Trump was found to be innocent in the investigation. He was found to be guilty in the investigation, but because of a Nixon-era memorandum in the legal counsel's office of the Department of Justice saying that we don't bring criminal charges against presidents while they're president. Okay, so that would have meant that immediately when he stepped down at 12 noon on January 20th, 2021, that charges could have been brought. But here, there was an amazing amount of legerdemain in the background involving William Barr personally. We're assured. We know that mostly as a result of the U.S. Attorney's own book about what happened, that was designed to protect and avoid the prosecution. And that then is what set up the current case by state prosecutors and delayed it, in fact, because while this federal investigation was going on, the New York state prosecution was preempted in a sense. So it really wasn't until the feds said they made the decision not to bring charges that the door was opened for the Manhattan District Attorney to act on this case.
So what do you know about Barr? Because I understand, Scott, that you're representing an FBI agent whose career was destroyed by Barr. Apart from the OLC memo, you can't indict a sitting president. What was he really up to here? Because later on, after the election, that Biden won, he seemed to at least turn and recognize the reality of it, although Barr has now come out saying what a disaster it would be to re-elect Biden. So given that you're defending somebody who's been hurt by Barr, what do you make of him?
Well, I think, and I am, I'm representing and have been advising several of the FBI agents who were investigating matters in the Southern District of New York relating to Rudy Giuliani and Parnas, but also this Michael Cohen business. And they were working with Jeffrey Berman, the U.S. attorney, basically acting under instructions of his office and going about doing their normal investigative work. And what happened? Barr fired Jeffrey Berman. I mean, in fact, issued a press release that he was fired, and Berman didn't even know about that, and certainly had not, in fact, been fired. So we had that whole mess about, that went over a period of about 6 weeks of him being dismissed and refusing dismissal and so on. But then Barr went after all the other people who were involved in these investigations, and that is the assistant U.S. attorneys who were working on the matters, the FBI agents who were doing investigations, and others. And they found suddenly that they were dismissed from their positions. They had they were transferred to other offices, and all these things were done as part of an effort to actually obstruct a criminal investigation and ensure that charges couldn't be brought against Trump and a number of people very close to him. So Rudy Giuliani in particular. So there was basically a glass dome that was put down around Giuliani to stop the progress of criminal cases, which were then being developed against him and several other people. So this was really all being orchestrated directly by William Barr and, against the decisions of the U.S. attorney and others. And it's maybe one of the darkest chapters in the history of the Department of Justice. It's a case of very clear-cut political interference and political obstruction of the criminal justice process. So what's going on right now in this case, which is described as a hush money case, but it's really not. I mean, in a sense, the bottom line here is efforts to interfere with the election, the 2016 election. So this was delayed by a period of many years by the conduct of William Barr.
Well, Scott Horton, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. We're going to take a brief station break and back to look into how Musk and Bezos, two of the richest men in the world, along with Starbucks billionaire Schultz and the Albrecht family that own Trader Joe's, are trying to destroy unions by getting rid of the National Labor Relations Board that has protected workers since the 1930s.
Here come the judge. Stop beating that fudge. Cause here come the judge. Don't nobody budge. Cause here come the judge. Judge Shorty is presiding the day. And he don't take no stuff from nobody. No kind of way. Hey boy, take off that hat.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Stephen Greenhouse, a senior fellow at the Century Foundation, who was previously a reporter for the New York Times, where he covered labor and the workplace for 19 years. He's the author of The Big Squeeze, Tough Times for the American Worker, and Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. And his latest articles at The Guardian are Trader Joe's and Starbucks are helping Elon Musk undermine the U.S. government. And victories would be nothing less than an earthquake. Can UAW win in the South? Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Greenhouse.
Good to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us. And there's some good news on the labor front, even though there's also the bad news of this existential threat to the labor movement itself, to unions, which have been, workers in America have been protected since the 1930s by the National Labor Relations Board, and a couple of billionaires, well, actually two of the richest men on the planet, Musk and Bezos, along with another billionaire, Howard Schultz of Starbucks, and the Olbrich family of Trader Joe's, are basically trying to get rid of the foundation of the labor movement. I mean, that's not a hyperbole, is it?
So these four companies, you know, which are, you know, basically non-union in the United States, are very unhappy that there have been efforts to unionize them, and so some successful efforts to unionize them. And they're doubly unhappy that the National Labor Relations Board, the top labor watchdog in the United States, has filed complaints against all four companies, accusing them of breaking the law and illegally retaliating against workers for speaking up or wanting to form a union. So SpaceX, you know, where Elon Musk owns 42% of the stock and has over 70% of the voting power, said, we don't like this. And they went to court to try to, like, kill, cripple, destroy, blow up the NLRB. You know, it's almost like Elon Musk is having a temper tantrum that the National Labor Relations Board is trying to hold him accountable. What happened was the labor board accused SpaceX of illegally firing eight workers, and all they did was write a letter to management and to fellow employees saying, we're unhappy that Elon Musk made light of news reports that Musk had paid $250,000 to silence to shut up a SpaceX flight attendant who accused Musk of exposing himself to her and demanding sex from her. And under American law, companies cannot retaliate against workers who band together to fight to improve, you know, their workplace, to improve workplace conditions. And the eight fired employees said, we are just trying to make SpaceX a better place. So on one hand, Elon Musk says, I'm a free speech absolutist, right? On the other hand, he's very happy to see SpaceX fire eight workers for merely writing a letter that criticized them. So much for being a free speech absolutist. So after SpaceX filed this lawsuit to have the NLRB declared unconstitutional, Starbucks, Amazon, and Trader Joe's also filed, you know, legal papers, you know, asserting that the NLRB is unconstitutional. So now you have these four very powerful, prominent companies, all kind of in ways led by billionaires, trying to kill, you know, the main federal agency that protects workers' right to unionize and to band together to speak up to improve conditions. So, you know, on one hand, and I've discussed this before on your radio show, Ian, you know, many labor leaders, many labor relations professors say there's something very wrong with the National Labor Relations Act because it's so weak. You know, when companies illegally fire workers for wanting to form a union, they can't be fined one penny, you know, if they're found guilty of breaking the law. So many unions think the National Labor Relations Act and the National Labor Relations Board is pathetically weak. Yet here we have Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk and Howard Schultz, you know, asking various judges to have the National Labor Relations Board declared unconstitutional. And if the NLRB is declared unconstitutional, that will create kind of an open season for companies to break the law even more in fighting against unions and firing workers who support unions. And workers would just be more vulnerable to exploitation. So these lawsuits are worrisome.
Well, I think they're worrisome because if they end up at the Supreme Court, this is the plutocratic-friendly Supreme Court we're talking about, the ones that where Justices Alito and Thomas hang out with billionaires.
So I read a story, an op-ed about this for The Guardian newspaper, which was posted yesterday. And I write that in many ways, you know, these four companies, these billionaires, are trying to take advantage of the rightward shift of the nation's courts. And we're seeing more courts, you know, starting from the Supreme Court on down, you know, many, you know, conservative justices are hostile to the so-called administrative state, you know, the network of federal agencies that have been created to protect workers, to protect the environment, to protect consumers, to protect small investors. And a lot of conservatives have declared war in the administrative state and want to weaken it, perhaps demolish it. So we have these four companies, you know, Starbucks, Amazon, Trader Joe's, and SpaceX, that have like signed on to this right wing effort assault to weaken, maybe cripple the administrative state. And, you know, Starbucks and Trader Joe's are kind of vulnerable because they hold themselves out as, we're goody goody progressive companies. We're hip. We have organic produce. We have fun things like lattes. We're very liberal. And yet, you know, they've joined what is essentially this right wing effort to weaken the federal government, to weaken the administrative state. So that's, you know, that is worrisome.
Well, it's particularly rich though when you consider that Musk, first of all, Tesla would not have got off the ground but for government subsidies, taxpayers' money, and SpaceX is subsidized by taxpayers' money. So here he is, along with his buddy Bezos and Schultz and the Olbrich family, who own Trader Joe's, going after the the government, in other words, biting the hand that feed them.
Yes. I mean, so in the story I wrote, then, so, you know, these federal, you know, a lot of people, a lot of concerns, a lot of businesses, they complain, they grouse about regulations. And yes, we have regulations, but, you know, the federal regulators, you know, whether the Securities and Exchange Commission or the Environmental Protection Agency or the National Labor Relations Board, they must be doing something right, because America has become the world's richest nation, and all these billionaires have become billionaires. And so they might grumble about these administrative agencies or the administrative state and all these regulations, but in many ways, it's created a very stable background that's enabled many corporations to become fabulously wealthy and these billionaires to become fabulously wealthy, while many workers haven't done so well. And you know, some of the people I've interviewed said there's something wrong when these billionaires, you know, like want to destroy the National Labor Relations Board, because, you know, it's annoying them, it's irking them, and they just want to get rid of it because they don't want to be bothered, they don't want to be fettered, shackled, restrained at all, and they want to get rid of all these regulations so that they could become even more fabulously wealthy.
So what about a consumer boycott against Starbucks and Trader Joe's? Is there anything brewing in that regard?
So there were, you know, 2 and 4 and 6 months ago, there was a lot of talk about trying to mount a consumer boycott against Starbucks. And about 3-4 months ago, there was a Starbucks day about 20 campuses across the U.S. where students at the campuses called for their colleges, the universities, to, you know, boot out Starbucks, to kick out Starbucks. And people thought that might begin to be the, you know, the beginnings of a nationwide consumer boycott. Anyway, then, you know, all of a sudden, like 6 weeks ago, Starbucks and the union, Starbucks Workers United, announced that Starbucks supposedly wants to make peace with the union, supposedly wants to finally, after dragging its feet for 2 years and getting almost nowhere in negotiations to reach a first contract with the union, Starbucks is signaling that it wants to turn the page, it wants to reach a contract, they're going to supposedly resume serious negotiations next week to move to a contract. And ever since Starbucks and the union announced that about 6 weeks ago, I think talk of a boycott has really sunk into the background, has fallen into abeyance, because people are, you know, hoping that Starbucks is serious and that it, you know, is ready to make peace and turn a page and reach a good contract with its union. And some people say, you know, so Starbucks has more than 9,000 company owned cafe stores in the United States. 400 have been unionized. And some people I speak to in the Starbucks union say, if we could really reach a good contract for these 400 stores, then maybe 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, you know, Starbucks stores will unionize. And that's a big deal. Starbucks has something like 300,000 workers at its 9,000 company-owned stores. So if you unionize a third of them, that's 100,000 workers. That's a lot of workers, right? So, you know, it's an exciting time for unions right now. With, you know, right now, workers in Chattanooga, Tennessee, at the Volkswagen plant are voting to unionize are voting whether to unionize and join the UAW. And there's a great confidence that they will win. The National Labor Relations Board announced today that it has scheduled an election, a unionization vote at the Mercedes-Benz plant in Vance, Alabama, outside Tuscaloosa. That's going to be between May 13th and May 17th. So, you know, one of the crazy things is, on one hand, workers are really jazzed for unions. We've seen that at Starbucks. We've seen that at Trader Joe's. We've seen them. We've seen that at Volkswagen. We've seen it at Mercedes-Benz. We've seen it at a million museums and colleges. Yet, at the same time, you know, these billionaires and the companies, you know, they hate unions. They oppose unions. They're allergic to unions. And, you know, they're asking, you know, the federal courts to declare the NLRB unconstitutional. And, you know, I know the Supreme Court is very conservative. I've written things criticizing them. But I think, as conservative as they are, I think that they concluded it's a bridge too far to declare the National Labor Relations Board unconstitutional.
Well, it goes back to the 1930s, but then stare decisis is is something that the Chief Justice has promised, but done the opposite. So I wouldn't hold my breath, but hopefully you're right. But just in closing, there are 4,300 Volkswagen workers in Chattanooga, Tennessee, voting as we speak. And if they win, it'll almost automatically give aid and comfort, won't it, to the workers at the Mercedes plant in Alabama and ripple throughout the South.
Yeah, absolutely. I had another story in The Guardian yesterday where I quote one of the nation's most prominent labor historians, Joseph McCartan at Georgetown. And he said it would be an earthquake if the union wins at VW and then Mercedes-Benz, because it's been extremely hard to win a unionization fight in the South. This would be the first time that workers at foreign-owned plants in the South, in the anti-union Right to Work South, would be voting in favor of a union. And the thought is, if they win at VW and Mercedes, then that will open the door to winning at Toyota or Hyundai or PMW or who knows where. So it'll be very exciting. And one of the things that's really, two of the things that really have held back unions in the United States over the last 20, 30, 40 years is many manufacturing workers are scared to vote to unionize because they worry if they unionize, their plants will go overseas. But, you know, the Volkswagen workers, the Mercedes workers, the BMW workers, they're not really worried that their plants will go overseas. And second, it's been hard to unionize manufacturing workers. Two, it's been very hard to unionize folks in the South. And if they win in Chattanooga, if they win in Alabama at Mercedes, that will show and trumpet very loudly that unions can win in the South. You know, on Monday, six Southern governors, you know, from Tennessee, Alabama, Mississippi, South Carolina, Texas, and I think Louisiana, sent out a letter about how bad it would be if the unions win in the South. And I think it would be great if, despite this governor's letter, you know, the workers say, this is none of your business. You know, don't tell us what we need to improve our lives at work. And I think it would send a very strong signal to workers across the South if the VW workers vote in favor of unionizing and the Mercedes-Benz workers vote in favor of unionizing, despite, you know, the pushback from the governors who are very pro-business and anti-union.
Well, Stephen Greenhouse, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Very good to talk, Ian. Keep well.
Thank you.
Good work. Okay.
And again, I've been speaking with Stephen Greenhouse, as a senior fellow at the Century Foundation, who was previously a reporter for the New York Times, where he covered labor and the workplace for 19 years. He's the author of The Big Squeeze, Tough Times for the American Worker, and Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. And his articles at The Guardian are Trader Joe's and Starbucks are helping Elon Musk undermine the U.S. government, and Victories Would Be Nothing Less Than an Earthquake. Can UAW win in the South? This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Evan Green to help us sustain this program into the future and ensure it remains free to all. Please take a moment to support us by going to backgroundbriefing.org/donate or publictruthmedia.org, where you will find our nonprofit Public Truth Media Foundation, where your tax-deductible donations, large and small, keep us broadcasting. And if you've missed any of today's programs or would like to explore our vast archives, you can find us at backgroundbriefing.org, where we include extended interviews searchable by topic and have made it easy for you to sign up for daily email updates that provide links to resources, articles, and books discussed on the program. Also, you can find links there to subscribe wherever you get your podcast, and we encourage your ratings and reviews on these platforms. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at Ian Masters Media, and please do help us reach more listeners by sharing this program with friends, family, and colleagues. And I'll be back again on Sunday with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.